We are carrying on our series in the book of Mark, chapter 5. And I'll have to be honest with you, this has not been the easiest sermon I've ever prepared. In fact, it's probably been the hardest. My wife will vouch for that, because I've really struggled to work out what to say, but I'll tell you a bit more about that. So we will read the whole of Mark, chapter 5. Starting from verse 1, they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the men went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him, and a woman who was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask who touched me." But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher any more?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of Jesus. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and told them to give her something to eat. just going to pray briefly. Lord, we just pray that you would open these words to us today, that we would just know something more of you and the way you want us to live as we study this passage. Amen. Right. It's quite a long passage, but I want to refer to various bits throughout it. In this passage, we've got three encounters of Jesus with the demon-possessed man, with Jairus and his daughter, and this chronically bleeding woman. And immediately preceding it is the miracle of Jesus calming the storm. And we can see in this chapter some of the themes that we've already picked up on that Chris set out right at the outset of this series. We can see some hints of where the story is heading, and we can see glimpses of the kingdom breaking in. Now, you will probably remember, or hopefully you'll remember, some of you, that David preached on some of this passage in March. He did a series called Unforgettable, when he picked up on some of the Aramaic phrases in the New Testament. And he preached about this Talitha Kum, and he kind of expanded the story of Jairus. I don't want to go over the same ground as possible. As I read this chapter, and I was thinking I would try and avoid that story altogether, but as I read it, there was one line that really kept leaping out at me. The woman said, "She's not dead, she's sleeping." And all I could think of when I read this was this video. I'm not sure if playing Monty Python has brought a premature end to my eldership. But as I prayed about what to preach, it just kept coming back. And I think it captures something of the response of the crowd. It says, you know, they laughed. Obviously, you know, all the commentators, the girl had died. It wasn't that there was any doubt that she had died. It talks about the people wailing outside. I didn't know this, but in the time that this was written, you would have professional mourners and wailers who would come and make a great noise outside the house, which was actually to allow the family to grieve properly. Because actually, you know, so often in our current climate, you just try and bottle it up and you don't want to be seen to be showing your emotions. But they wanted to let them be able to be as distressed as they needed to be without feeling embarrassed. So this girl had died, and Jesus comes along and said, she's not dead, she's asleep. And you can just imagine them, you know, exactly like that, just laughing at him, thinking, you must be crazy. I suspect it probably captures something of the response of many in the world today. At least in the Western world, you know, the idea that God is dead, faith is dead, religion is dead. And I think probably I suspect it captures something of our response some of the time. We hear of miracles, we hear of God doing things in this day and age. We even see him doing things amongst us, yet we can so often then struggle for faith so quickly afterward. At least I know I can. So I think that there's something in these stories that can speak to us individually as we seek to grow in faith, but also as we seek to see others come to faith in Jesus and step out on this new vision that Chris has started to bring to us. So I think what I want to say today is actually quite simple, a simple encouragement to try and build our faith. I could go through what all the commentators have said about the stories in Mark chapter 5, about the background to all these encounters. But actually, I think it's probably more about a heart response than a head response I want to encourage today. And I think that's probably why I struggled so much when I was planning what to say. I like to have everything worked out and very much in order. I have a very analytical mind. I think quite a lot. I think I probably think too much. That's a strength sometimes, but I'm pretty sure there are many times when it holds me back. And even planning this, as I said, I wanted to make sure everything had a clear structure and a clear message, and I really couldn't find it. I read, I prayed, I read some more, I wrote some notes, I wrote some more notes, I reviewed the notes, I read the same stuff again, I listened to some sermons online about it, and I was really struggling for inspiration. All I kept coming back to was that line, she's not dead, she's asleep. And just that lack of faith that you saw in those people. To the incredulity of them and the challenge it made to me, to my own lack of faith at times, of what Jesus can do today. And I really had that sense, you know, and I think lots of people preach it, when you think, I can't go and preach something that I'm struggling with myself. It really, when you really go deep in something and you look at it hard, it kind of is just like shining a light into your own heart, your own soul, your own mind. And, you know, I know the right things in my head and I know all the right stuff to say and, you know, you've even seen it, but sometimes you just really struggle deep down. I know I do. And just think, well, why am I not seeing the miraculous today through, you know, what I'm doing? Why is that not happening? And maybe there's some of you the same. At an elders' meeting recently, we were encouraged when we were just praying to ask God for something that we needed at that time. And I just asked for more faith. Now, I even felt in that setting, slightly awkward, thinking, crikey, I'm an elder. People have elected, you know, me or recognised me to be one of the leaders of this church. And I'm here, you know, just thinking, asking for faith and struggling with all this stuff. Even when I hear these amazing things happening, some of you probably will have read on Facebook this week, I think it came out, about another amazing healing at Valdebrennen of a woman who's been blind for 8 years, who was now using a guide dog and a white stick, who just in one of the meetings there, her sight was completely restored. She was able to see her husband, who she hadn't seen for 8 years. And we see these amazing things, we hear of these amazing things, and I think, what is it holding me back? We've seen things in this fellowship, we've seen, you know, healings happen. We've seen people going out treasure hunting and finding their treasure or delivering their treasure, whichever way you want to look at it. what's holding me back? What's holding others of us back? I'm sure there's others of you that feel the same. Is it fear? Is it doubt? Is it a lack of opportunity? I suspect it's probably all three and more. So what can we learn from these stories here? And I just want to briefly remind you of where it's come from. 2 weeks ago, Josh preached on chapter 4. And there's a number of links from that. So in chapter 4, Jesus, and the one that Josh picked up on, was the parable of the sower. And there's a number of things that Jesus was teaching in parables that we see recorded in chapter 4 that actually we then see some practical demonstrations of some of those points in this chapter. And we then go to four power miracles. So Jesus had been teaching. He then gets on the boat and he leaves where he was teaching and goes across, we now see, into Gentile territory. And when he was on the boat, that's when the storm came up. And lots of you will know the story of Jesus sleeping in the boat and the storm raged. And the disciples, you know, just panic. They're not quite sure what's going to do. They think, you know, they're all going to die. And Jesus, then they wake him and he calms the storm. He then lands on the shores in Gentile territory and we see the story of him casting out demons. He then heals the sick woman. He then raises Jairus' daughter from the dead. And as I said, as we step on this journey, as we think about the vision that Chris is bringing to us as a church, and as a church we need to, you know, buy into that, and I think that's what we did when we recognised Chris's call to us. It's a vision that is for us to step out. It's a vision that requires us to have faith and start to walk in what God has got for us. And not faith in Chris, but faith in Christ. And I'm constantly struck, Gary's not here today, but I think Gary has been really honest in a number of meetings I've been in, when he's, you know, he's had really clear pictures that we need to be out of the building, but he's terrified about what that actually might look like, but he's got a desire to conquer it. And to do that, we need to build faith. So faith is complete trust or confidence in someone or something. And I'm sure you've probably, many of you heard of the sort of analogy of a bridge. When you step onto a bridge, you've got faith in it. Why do we have faith or trust in something or someone? Well, because we know someone, because we see what they've done before, because of our own experience, because of the experience of other people we trust telling us. You know, I was talking to Tanya this morning. We're trying to find various tradesmen to do things in our house, and it's so hard to find someone that you think, can I trust them? You want someone who can actually vouch for them and give you you know, a good recommendation, or someone that you've used before and you know you can trust. We need to have, if we're going to have faith, we need complete trust in Jesus. We need to have faith in the person of Jesus and not in the circumstances we see around us. And I think, and when we look at that story of she's not dead, she's asleep, did they have faith in Jesus, or were they just looking at the circumstances? And we've got the contrast here of the disciples at the end of chapter 4 in the story of Jesus calming the storm. So we've got these guys who've been walking with Jesus, these guys seeing him in action, learning from him, spending time with him, hearing his teaching. These are, you know, I guess the guys who, you know, we might say they're a bit like us, trying to journey along in faith. And even after he's calmed the storm, they're terrified. So at the end of chapter 4, if I can work out how to get my phone to go back a chapter, which it's not wanting to do, even after they have he's calmed the storm, we see that they're terrified. They don't understand. They're afraid. They're like, who is this guy? They're still trying to really grasp what it is. So we've got the disciples, these guys who are on the journey, who should know what's going on, struggling to really grasp this and to get this. And then we've got the demon-possessed man, who at the end of the story, Jesus says, no, don't come with me. You stay here. You share what I've done for you with other people. Now, you'll recall that in other stories, Jesus said, don't tell anybody. Even at the end of that story, Jesus said, don't tell anybody about what had happened with Jairus' daughter. Now, there's two kind of things there going on. First of all, we've already talked about Jesus having a strategy and having tactics. And he was, the story of Jairus was in Jewish territory, where he's trying not to create too much of a stir too early, because he's got a plan of where he wants this journey to go. And the story with the demon-possessed man is in Gentile territory, where the same constraints don't apply. But actually, what's the commentators have said is what's really going on here is that this guy, the demon-possessed man, Jesus has cast out the demons. He has realized that his whole life has been in Jesus' hands and Jesus has brought restoration. He's learned what it's like to put your whole life and future in Jesus' hands and what comes of that. Jesus, therefore, as kind of, he's grasped what it is to have faith, and Jesus deems him ready to stay and spread the kingdom in Gentile territory. It's almost the first apostolic mission that he's sent out. His disciples are not ready to do that yet. He's not sending them out to do anything yet. They're still learning, but this guy has been able to grasp it, to put his whole life in Jesus' hands. And you'll remember that if you were here when Josh preached and he talked about the parable of the sower, he talked about Jesus being a demanding Lord. And he contrasted Jesus wanting to change culture, wanting to change behaviour. When you make him Lord, he wants to change the way you behave, change the way you act, the way you think. And how the Roman Empire didn't do that. So the Romans invaded a land. They didn't want to impose culture. They just wanted to rule with the rule of law. They wanted to collect taxes. They wanted authority over that place. But how you actually got on and did your day-to-day living, they weren't so worried about. And there's another contrast here. The Romans, they came in force. And you see this guy, Legion. The way it's described is this guy who's been totally terrorized by the Roman invasion. You see, called Legion, this whole idea that the Roman legions had come in. They totally overwhelmed him. The demons had come into him, and he could not be controlled. And the fact that the Roman Empire had been deeply damaging to this guy, whereas Jesus comes humbly as a servant. He doesn't come to conquer or to damage, but he comes to bring restoration and freedom. That's the man that we have faith in. Now, I personally feel like I relate better to the disciples at this stage, these people who are kind of bumbling along, struggling to really grasp the whole thing of kingdom and faith. And I'm encouraged that the disciples kind of got there in the end. But these power miracles demonstrate that we can have complete confidence in a man that can cast out demons, complete confidence in a man that calms the storm, complete confidence in a man that heals the woman unwell for 12 years, complete confidence in a man that raised a dead girl back to life. And as we said, that's just a pointer of the things to come. The real healing was going to come through Jesus's death. So we've got Jesus, this man that we are called to have faith in, that is the source of power. But faith is then the channel down which Jesus's power can flow. So I want to look very briefly at the encounter with the bleeding woman. We know she's had this condition for 12 years. She's exhausted all human efforts at healing. She doesn't want to make a scene. She's ritually unclean. Bodily fluids were a big problem in the Jewish culture. But she has faith. She must have heard something of what Jesus was doing. She's heard about him, we know. And she says, if only she can touch his cloak, and she manages it. Jesus feels the power go out of him. And then he says, your faith has healed you. Is it the faith that heals? Or is it Jesus' power? Well, it's Jesus that heals, but it was, he felt the power leave him. But it was her faith that made the channel for that power to flow. A bit like a cable allows the electricity to flow down it. We know that he was in a crowd. Jesus was being jostled. All the disciples couldn't believe that he noticed someone touched him. Obviously, lots of people were touching him. Not everybody was being healed. He didn't feel power going out to everybody that was touching him. There's something different. There is Jesus' power, and then there is the openness, the faith of the recipient. He's not just doing magic tricks for a passive audience. He's actually wanting to touch people's lives and see people develop faith. So how do we build faith? How do you start to work that out? And I believe it's, for us, it's going to be small steps. It's a journey that we're on as a church together to see our faith built. It means seeing your faith stretched. I think faith is a muscle. Muscles don't get built, unfortunately, by sitting down on the sofa. They get built by exercise and training. If we don't use them, they atrophy, they waste away. And also the other thing is you can't build your muscles by watching other people do it. It's even more disappointing. And one of the lines that really struck me in one of the books I read was, true faith is a self-risking trust in Jesus himself. It's self-risking. That whole thing, you know, you see all these people watching football matches at the weekend, and most of them would do better to actually probably go and play some football and improve their own health and fitness than watch other people doing it. Watching other people doing it isn't going to make the difference. If we just look very briefly at Jairus, he took a risk. Jairus, we know, was a synagogue president, which sounds like quite a grand title. He was probably in a fairly small village, so it wasn't a really, you know, senior role, but he was part of the establishment. He was part of the establishment that is already slightly concerned about what Jesus is doing, about this kind of revolution that is starting from the ground up. In his role, to then start to, you know, be going and asking Jesus for help was, you know, potentially career suicide. It was really not going to bring positive attention from his superiors. But he's desperate. His little girl is dying. And he goes and throws himself on the ground at Jesus, hoping that Jesus can do something about it. He's taken a risk. He's obviously got some faith that something can happen, and he takes that risk. So I think we, individually and as a church, need to exercise our faith muscle. We need to take small steps of faith. And I was thinking about, obviously, because it's pertinent at the moment, the Love Running training program. And how I said earlier, there's all these people who 9 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, couldn't run to the bus stop. And they're on the verge of being able to run 10K. Some have already done it in training. And what they've done is they, at the beginning, you know, the first day, they maybe walked for a minute, jogged for a minute, walked for a minute, jogged for a minute. And they didn't do that for very long. And then by the second week, they would maybe do that for 20 minutes, you know, 1 minute walking, 1 minute jogging. And then the next week they'd do 1 minute walking and 2 minutes jogging. And within a few weeks they could run for 10 minutes and then they could run for 20 minutes. And in 2 weeks' time they'll be running for an hour and a half. What they've done is they've trained their bodies. They've trained their muscles to get used to it. Their bodies have got stronger. And I think that's what we've seen people here start to do. We have, you know, we're not necessarily going out and you know, healing hundreds and thousands of people. We've seen people want to make a start. But as I said, we can't just leave it for those chosen few. I think there's a challenge for each of us individually that that's for us. Now, it's great to hear testimony of what Jesus is doing amongst us, of people taking those small steps. I think of Ruth going to the coffee shop when on the women's breakfast a few weeks ago and just asking God for a word for someone and sharing that with the lady who worked in the coffee shop. I've heard Chris, you know, mention previous times when he was working at Newport about his interactions, I think, with one of the cleaners there when he was at the airport somewhere. You know, but he's taking a risk. You know, that moment when you go up to someone, you say, I believe God's got something for you, you think this could go terribly wrong. I could look like a prize idiot. You're taking a risk. And until, you know, it pans out, you don't know what's going to go on. But you have to have faith in Jesus and not in the circumstances. But I think what those people have done is they've started to exercise their faith muscle and they see God come through and they can tell us about it. But until we actually start to take the challenge on, I don't think we're going to see our own faith muscle strengthened. And perhaps for me, as I was preparing, I think, you know, the challenge is for me to really do that. And over the last few weeks, I've tried to do that. There was an opportunity to just offer to pray for my brother-in-law, a guy who's an atheist who, you know, had a situation going on. And he emailed about a situation with his work. And I just emailed back and said, I'll pray for you about that. You know, I was able to kind of disarm it and, you know, explain what I was trying to do. But actually, when I sent that email and pressed send, I was thinking, crumbs, you know, this guy is now going to think I'm, you know, even more crazy than he thought before. We've had the odd discussion around the dinner table and usually it's, you know, kind of gone into slightly awkward territory. So I wasn't quite sure what he thought about it, but we offered to pray for him and Tanya was able to do the same. But that point when you know, when you click send, when you engage with someone and you speak to someone, there is a risk. But I think we have to do that. You have to see that then God does stuff. You know, in that situation, God has done stuff and sorted out the situation that he was in. Now, whether my brother-in-law attributes that to God or not, I suspect he doesn't. But I think it will at this stage. But there's, you know, I know there's other people around him who've got faith, who've come into his life. And I hope that over time he'll see a pattern of things come together. So maybe I'd just like to encourage you. You need to offer to pray for people. You need to take that risk. Offer to pray for healing for people, whether it's here or in home groups. Try this stuff out. Maybe in your prayer triplet, you could, you know, try the whole coffee shop treasure hunting thing. I'm sure if in my one, it would probably be in a pub rather than a coffee shop. Go and try that stuff. Ask God for a word for someone and actually just try and do it. And I'm sure we'll be pleasantly surprised at what happens. And come back and share testimony. Because I think that is important that we do that. But each of us, we can't just rely on the testimony of others. We need to start taking that risk ourselves. That will build our own faith muscle. I think it also gives us the opportunity to build the faith muscle in other people. Not everyone will respond. We look at those stories. There were crowds in each situation. There was the crowd that came and witnessed the demon-possessed man who was restored, and they just told Jesus to get out. There was the crowd that saw the woman healed, who then couldn't believe what was going on. There was the crowd outside Jairus' house who just scorned. But actually, as we, and again, it's that link to the parable of the sower. Lots of people won't respond, but some did. Some of those people that had the encounters with Jesus had their life restored. And just finally, I just want to read one thing. If we're going to do that, yes, we can practice in home groups, but we can't just do it amongst each other. We're not going to build faith with those that don't know Jesus in here very much. Yes, we can invite them in, but actually the majority of the people in here will already know Jesus. We need to be where these people are. And this was just a short paragraph in one of the commentaries, and it says, "Our need to be where Legion is. This stirring drama, once generalized and applied to our day, may come as a challenge to our Christian witness. In how many ways are people individually and corporately living lives which in one form or another reflect the particular elements or the overall state of the man called Legion? Jesus was exposed to such people and needs by his wandering presence. He was ready for the necessary confrontation between good and evil that a captive might be set free. At political, social and economic structural levels, as well as in cultural, family and individual areas of life, the demonstration of the power of Jesus to set free through his disciples is still awaited, while too often the disciples are hidden away in our churches or comfortable subcultures. The sense of God's transcendent power in the midst of society, expressing itself in lowly, liberating love, is not known because his disciples, the chosen avenues of that powerful love, are largely absent." If we're going to make a difference, we need to be out there. We need to buy into this whole idea, what Chris has brought, what Gary's been saying, what other people have brought to us as a fellowship. We need to be out there. And most of us are out there. We're out there in work. We're out there with our neighbours. We're out there where we're studying in school. We're out there when we're shopping. It's not like we just spend 24/7 in this room. But actually, a lot of what we do in our walk with God, sometimes we can limit into this room. Let's take it out. So, just to conclude, she's not dead, she's sleeping. What's our response to those words? We need to build our faith in Jesus and not on the circumstances. Faith is the channel through which Jesus' power can flow, and we need to build our faith muscle. We need to train it. We need to give God opportunities to use it. We need to ask for those opportunities and take a risk. And we need to try and bring restoration to those that are dead. So perhaps it's just me, but perhaps some of you are like the disciples as well. Perhaps you've been wanting to walk a life with more faith for some time, but are struggling to take the risk. Perhaps now is a time just to recommit to exercise that faith muscle. And it struck me a bit like Love Running. Perhaps we need to start kind of a training program for our faith muscles individually, maybe in your prayer triplet, in your home group, and say, you know, over the course of the next week, next 10 weeks or whatever it is, we're going to follow a training program. I don't know. But I think as a church, if we're really going to fulfill the vision that God has sent to us, we need to develop our faith muscles.